From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, how a Stanford graduate took her STEM degree and put it to use at 200 miles an hour on the racetrack.
Later, what a harm reduction model looks like when it's used to fight opioid addiction.
It's a set of programs to reduce the risks and harms associated with drug use, but not necessarily having the end goal of abstinence. Abstinence can be an outcome, but it's not the only outcome.
And in this month's On That Note, cellist Robert Cohen says when it comes to transporting his 300-year-old cello in the extreme cold, it acts like a very crotchety old man.
That real worry about the wood cracking and the glue that holds it together drying out. And I mean, I've had nightmares, like most musicians have nightmares, of opening the cello case and finding a pile of dust at the bottom.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. We have done quite a few interviews over the years about where education in the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, fits into the 21st century economy. In particular, there's been a concerted effort to attract more girls into the field so that someday there will be more women in engineering and tech fields. Girls can follow in the footsteps of astronomer Annie Jump Cannon, who cataloged 350,000 stars, or perhaps Changsheng Wu, the first lady of physics who worked on the Manhattan Project.
Or they could try not to be left in the dust by Julia Landauer, who advocates for girls in STEM as she competes as a NASCAR driver. Landauer is also a Stanford graduate and a former competitor on the TV show Survivor. She will give the keynote speech at the Mount Mary University Voices of Leadership event this month. But ahead of that, she joined us by phone from her home in North Carolina. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's go to your origin story, if we could. What was it that first drew you to auto racing? I mean, was speed part of who you were before that point?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like going fast on my bike in Central Park. But what it was really was that my parents were looking for an activity that all of their kids could do together on the weekends. They're me and my two siblings. And then they were also looking for an activity that their girls could do head-to-head against the boys, you know, up all the levels of the sport. And so racing is one of the few, and I started in go-karts, and I loved it right away. I loved, you know, the speed. I really loved winning, and, you know, beating the boys was really cool at age 12. And then I also really appreciated working with adults and the human-machine interaction and getting that technical and mechanical experience. And being held accountable for my part in making a race go well. So it was just really exciting and a lot of adrenaline.
Well, and it sounds like from the very beginning, the message was that that gender wasn't the most important thing here, that you could compete on a level that anybody could compete at.
Yeah, and I'm definitely quite lucky that I have the parents that I have, right? And, you know, they fully believe that their girls and boys could do anything. And, you know, they held their son to the same, you know, emotional IQ that they held their daughters, and they held their daughters to the same, you know, physical, mechanical, you know, IQ that they held their son. So it was really, really lucky. And at the end of the day, I think that there are so many like externally imposed barriers to women, to minorities, that if you can break those down, that's where you really see some magic happen.
It's funny. You were saying you're riding your bike in Central Park. New York City is not necessarily a place where everybody has a car, especially a kid.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, I didn't actually get my driver's license till I was 18, just because if that, you know, in New York, you can't get it till you're 18. But yeah, I mean, it wasn't a normal sport for the city. And so we went to a go-kart track that was about 2 hours outside of New York City. The same go-kart track that Marco Andretti, you know, grandson of Mario Andretti, raced at. And it really became the weekend family activity. And there was 1 year where we raced 27 weekends out of the year. And so it was quite a lot. And we traveled to the national races, which were, you know, in the Midwest and the South. And so it was really cool. Actually, one of my favorite go-kart tracks was in Wisconsin. So
really?
It was up in Shawano, Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you to figure out that you liked it and that you could be good at it?
Well, I won my first race, like, in my sixth or seventh race of my rookie season in go-karts, and that really was kind of the addictive moment. But I had a really clear idea that this was something I wanted to pursue right about the time I was 12, which, again, I realize is totally lucky to kind of have that epiphany so early. But that being said, you know, every year my parents, you know, made sure that I was willing to do the hard work to keep racing and that I was willing to make the sacrifices that would have to be made. So they helped keep me grounded. And I saw that there were other 12 and 13 year olds who were getting into racing cars specifically, not go-karts. And I thought, if they can do it, I can do it. And so I worked with my parents and, you know, they supported me and we did the research. And, you know, every year I knew that I was going to have to put a lot in, and I knew that my parents were not going to be able to pay for racing, you know, till the end of time. And so, you know, really understanding the business side of it became very important and something that I had to address early on. I wasn't just able to go out and race and just have fun with it, right? I had to look at it as a career, therefore as a business.
Right. And of course, not every NASCAR driver goes to Stanford. Why was it important that, you know, that education was an important element of who you wanted to become?
Yeah, education's always been really important. And I went to a high school that specialized in math and science. It was a public school, but it was one of, you know, the specialized public high schools in New York City. So I had this emphasis on academia and STEM. And so for me, there were a couple of things. One, kind of going back to the business side, I knew that I was going to have to become smarter about how I presented myself, how I marketed myself, how I presented ROI to a potential investor or sponsor. So there was that component. But then there was also just the interest from the technical standpoint of racing. You know, there's a lot of cutting edge technology going on in Silicon Valley from the digital side, from the autonomous side. And then there was racing, which is a very tech-centric sport. And so for me, I was always interested in how could I bridge those worlds, whether while I'm racing or when I retire from racing, you know, how can I continue that endeavor of marrying Silicon Valley and racing, if you will.
Do all drivers have that kind of technical sophistication or at least attitude towards it?
Well, I think you can't be a dummy and go racing, right? You cannot you know, be dumb and operate a machine at 200 miles an hour within inches of a wall for hours on end. So I think that's a bad rep that some racing can have. But, you know, it varies. I think there are a lot of drivers that do have a very strong technical understanding of the vehicle, and they understand the physics involved with it and vehicle dynamics, even if it's not from a formal education setting. From, you know, being hands-on with their car and getting on the track every weekend, a lot of people learn that. And then there are racers who don't know as much about the technical side. And I think I have a happy medium of really being technically literate with the vehicle and with the race car, and also understanding some outside applications as well.
I also remember interviewing some years back, gosh, probably 15 years ago, there was a guy who had just graduated from MIT who had made it to the major leagues. He was in his first spring training with, I think it was the San Diego Padres, and we talked about the fine line between taking a sophisticated intellectual approach but not overthinking things. Has that ever been an issue for you?
That's a great question. And yeah, it has, to be perfectly honest. You know, sometimes you can get so focused on the process and overthinking. And I think that's how drivers tend to psych themselves out a little bit, whether or not they have a higher education background. But sometimes you just have to go by the seat of your pants, right? You just have to do what feels right. You have to do what your gut tells you. In racing, you know, some of the best passes or the most iconic passes for wins or for whatever position, you know, they don't come from a calculated effort. They come because you're in a position and you make the gut instinct to make a move. And so it is a really fine balance, and one that I'm glad other people are experiencing in other sports.
So let me ask you a strange question. Where in all of this that you do did your year, your season on Survivor come in?
Great question. So I tried out and got accepted to be on Survivor when I was 20 years old. So it was my sophomore year of college. Now, when I was in college, I still raced every season, but I only did a handful of races during the summer. So it was a partial season. And what I did was in that year, we filmed in 2012, and I didn't have a whole lot lined up for racing. And so I got this opportunity and I just decided, you know what, I got to go for it. This is so cool. And hopefully it'll, you know, help my racing image. It didn't really very much, but that was my fault. And I got back in end of May or beginning of June, and maybe it was end of June, I forget at this point, but then I actually went racing a few months later after I had adequately rehabbed and regained my strength. So it was astonishing. Really weird.
Well, if life is a collection of experiences, this is one of them, right?
Definitely. And, people ask me if I would do it again, and I would love to redeem myself. I think I made a strategic error. But at the same time, it would be so hard for me to justify not going racing for it. So it's the kind of thing where, when you have these opportunities, you got to take them and really make the most of them, because you don't know if you'll get them again. So, to your point, you've got to grab life by the horns and really, really make the best of it.
So you are speaking at a women's leadership event in Milwaukee. That is why we're speaking. You speak at a lot of events about your racing career, but also your educational background, your entrepreneurship, your place as a role model. That is a lot to put on one person.
Yeah, but I guess I like keeping busy. And it's really exciting to get on stage and to be very vulnerable with an audience and then kind of share their enthusiasm for what you're saying. And the way I see it is that if I'm able to positively impact one person, if I'm able to make one person think critically about themselves or make some change or readjust their outlook on the world, then that's a success. And my first talk was actually at TEDx Stanford, and it was really great because I got some coaching and I was in a comfortable environment. And I found that I was experiencing an adrenaline rush, not quite as intense as what I get on the racetrack, but it was still there. And it still requires that preparation and getting on stage and being vulnerable and putting it all out there. And so it's definitely a lot, but there's a lot of satisfaction in making a big group of people laugh and, also learning what doesn't work so well. So it's really cool and it's fun to talk with people afterwards. So I'm glad I get to make the trip out there.
Do you get to be vulnerable on stage in a way that you can't afford to be when you're on a racetrack?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I think because there's no direct competition when I'm on stage, it's definitely a little different. And, I don't have some of these more intimate life lesson and learning experience conversations with my competitors or with my crew even that I have with the audience. So, yeah, it definitely is an outlet that you don't necessarily get at the racetrack.
There's obviously a lot of danger in a race car going 200 miles an hour, inches from a wall. But are there things that scare you in anything that you do that might surprise people?
Yeah. So racing is definitely scary. It's really reassuring to know that these cars are almost built to take a hit. And so they look really terrifying and scary, but really it's because the car absorbs all the energy of a crash so the driver doesn't. So they're actually quite safe, and it's been over a decade since there's been a death in NASCAR, so that's great. But the first time you go 174, 175 miles an hour really catches your attention. When it comes to fears, I think, one, everyone has them, and I think using fear to help motivate you to go forward is a really crucial skill that's worth working on and developing. And I think probably the biggest fear that I have that people can relate to is a fear of failure. And whether that was when I was at school, whether it's with my career as a race car driver, fear of not making it is definitely terrifying. And it's more abstract, so it's hard to wrap your head around. But the desire to not fail, I think, is part of what helps me keep after it and keep, hustling so much to make my dreams come true.
How long had you been racing when you had your first crash?
Oh, I crashed my go-kart early on. But my first really big crash in a car, I think I had one where it was on a road course, so you turn left and right. So I was 14 at this time. It was the year that I won a championship, but on one of the practice days before I won that race, I dropped two wheels, like the two right side wheels, off of the racetrack and into the grass. And when grass is wet, it's very, very, very slippery, and it's hard to slow down. So it had rained the night before, and I just shot into the outside barrier, which is probably a good 30 or 40 feet from the track, but I just had so much speed that I crashed that. And there's a lot more damage to the car than like what I felt, but it's terrible. It's awful. It's expensive. You're not going to be able to get back in the car for a little while. And so it you try to avoid it at all costs.
So Danica Patrick is retiring after, I think, what, Daytona and the Indianapolis 500. What did her career mean to yours?
Yeah, that's a great question, and one that's quite common, but I think is very different to every female racer out there. And for me, you know, I totally applaud her being the first woman in modern, you know, modern racing to really continuously compete at the top level of NASCAR. I'm not sure I would want to be the first. And it was really cool in her, you know, more recent times to hear some of the struggles that she felt like with respect to how teams treated her and how other drivers treated her on track. Cause it's all stuff that I've experienced as well. And from a branding perspective, I would probably do some things differently. So I think what's really cool is that even though we're both fairly petite brunette female race car drivers, she has such a different brand from what I have. And I feel like I still have plenty of room to be myself. And I think in no matter what industry, once there's one female that's prominent, sometimes, unfortunately, it seems like people are like, okay, you know, we've got our one, we don't need another. And I think that there's a lot of room to continue to be my own person, my own brand, in a field that has had such a prominent female role model. So, multifaceted answer to your question, right. But that's it. Yeah.
Well, and I guess I thought about Danica Patrick and thinking about all the various aspects of your life in which you serve as a role model. There are plenty of male NASCAR drivers just as NASCAR drivers. Is it fair for you to have all these other things, or is it just something that you welcome?
I mean, overall, it's something that I welcome. And when it comes to the gender question, like, I think many female racers would agree that they'd like to be known as a great race car driver. They wouldn't want to be just a great female race car driver, right? Because there are only a handful of us. So what's that really saying? But I do think it's important to have the conversation about the significance of women really starting to break through from a driving side, but then also from an engineering side and a, you know, mechanic side, because there are only so many women in the garage. And so in terms of having that conversation, I think at this stage is crucial. When we see, you know, 50-50 representation of men and women, then the conversation doesn't have to be as loud, in my opinion. But until we see that, and I think that's culturally, until we see women getting paid equally, until we see, you know, more safety for women, I mean, we need to have these conversations. So the fact that I have different things going on to my brand and my platform than just racing, I think is a really cool opportunity to continue to spread that message.
All right. Well, let me ask you the question to end that I'm sure you get a lot. When you are not on the track, what kind of car do you drive and what kind of driver are you?
Yeah, I drive a Volkswagen GTI, stick shift manual, very important.
Oh, yeah.
And I am a driver that sets cruise control, because when you get one too many tickets, you just decide it's not worth it anymore. So, but I'll be honest, I don't love driving on the road. On the racetrack, I can be really offensive and everything. And I think on the road, I have to be way more defensive. So as much as other people can drive me around, I'll take it.
Well, listen, Julia Landauer, it was a thrill to get to chat with you. Thank you so much for your time, your insights, and everything you do.
Thank you. And everyone is free to reach out on social media. I love engaging with fans. So at Julia Landauer is where I'm at. And it's always fun to hear from you guys.
Julia Landauer is a NASCAR driver and a STEM education and women's advocate. The Stanford grad in science, technology, and society will give the keynote later this month at Mount Mary University's Voices of Leadership event. You'll find a link to more information at wuwm.com.
Keep listening. We talk weather extremes with cellist Robert Cohen next. On that note, our regular series on the life of a touring classical musician comes your way after a break on Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Each month, cellist Robert Cohen joins us to talk about life as a touring classical musician in a segment we call On That Note. We've talked about traveling with an instrument, how you deal with performing while jet-lagged, and the reality of missing your family when out on an extended tour.
Well, this month, it's all about everyone's second favorite topic, the weather. For most of us, weather is either nice or annoying, but musicians monitor temperatures and humidity levels with a devotion verging on the fanatical. Robert joins me on Skype now from his home in London. Hello, Robert.
Hi, Bonnie. I'm very well. It feels so long since I last talked to you.
I know. It's not been that long.
But, you know, sometimes it just seems so long.
Well, we've both been so busy, and that's part of it, too. And one of the things that is so interesting, I was about to say happy March, which it is, but in the UK, things are a little wintry right now.
Yeah, well, I just got back, luckily, even, because, I mean, it just had Siberian snow, and pretty much everything comes to a standstill. And my flight came in from Vienna, and I thought, well, that was just lucky. That was just lucky.
Yeah, I've been seeing pictures from friends in Scotland where it's like 10 inches of snow, 12. Now, here in Wisconsin, we kind of go, oh, okay. You know, but I know in the UK that's rare, unless you're up on Ben Nevis or something like that.
Yeah, and it's 80-something percent humidity, which makes it feel miserable.
And so, of course, my thought goes to how the heck do you protect an instrument in that kind of weather? Because just because there's snow and it's that cold, you're not stopping your career. You're not stopping tours. Musicians are still going places and playing. You know, how do you protect your cello in that kind of extreme temperature?
Well, if you imagine it's like taking, I mean, my cello is almost 300 years old. So it's like taking a 300-year-old man out in the snow, really. I mean, it's frightening. I mean, you think that the instrument is like, you know, an eighth of an inch thick wood. And it's so old and so fragile. And you suddenly expose it to this freezing temperatures. And perhaps even worse than that, the complete lack of humidity sometimes. It can be so dry. And that real worry about the wood cracking and the glue that holds it together drying out and the whole thing falling apart. I mean, I've had nightmares, like most musicians have nightmares, of opening the cello case and finding a pile of dust at the bottom, you know, can be such an awful thought. And, you know, it is really worrying. And I'm hearing stories of people all over the world, actually, with their old instruments cracking. And it's so dangerous. It's like, can you imagine like a drum skin cracking and then trying to still use the drum? I mean, it just not going to work when it cracks.
So what do you do? I mean, obviously we've talked about cases before, and that protects the instrument from bumps and bruises, physical ones. But does the case protect from cold in any way?
Well, not a lot. And you know what? I've discovered fairly recently that I put the cello into a silk bag. So I enclose the cello. It's a bit like wearing something silk. It seems to slow down the you know, insulates quite well. So I put my cello into this silk bag and tie it up and then put that into the cello case. And I have to say that, you know, I'm obviously trying to be outside for as little time as possible, trying to get from the house or the hotel into the taxi or somewhere like that as quickly as possible. And that silk bag does seem to be quite effective. You can tell, actually, because the bows, which are in the case as well, they're not in the silk bag. And when you take them out to use them, they're really freezing. I mean, they just lose their heat immediately. But the cello seems to be a little bit warmer, which is, you know, it's gratifying and also just not, you know, it stops me worrying quite so much about it.
Well, is it the change in temperature that's so bad for it, or is it just the cold itself?
No, I think the change of temperature, when it's very dramatic, obviously isn't going to do it any good. And I suppose, really, if it's when it's so dry, what happens is all the moisture in the wood disappears, and then it becomes so brittle and so hard, and it shrinks, in fact. And in fact, with the bows, for instance, when there's no humidity, the hair of the bow shrinks and it tightens the stick, really. You have to keep loosening it to try to deal with that difference in tension, and that you feel that with the strings as well, because they're drying out when you play. And they become much more resistant to moving. And when you're playing softly and it's really dry, for instance, it's very hard to make the sound. And you know, you're playing something quite loud and then gradually play softly. And then suddenly the strings, they just won't move because the dryness is affecting them. And it makes it very difficult to control the sound at that point. And sometimes when you're rehearsing and you're with a group of people and everything seems to be okay to start with, but at, you know, over an hour or two, the instruments all dry up, and everybody's struggling madly to make quality sound. And you know, for instance, the moment you get the opportunity to try to rehydrate the instrument, you know, I get back to my hotel room, for instance, I'll put on a hot shower and steam up the room as quickly as possible and kind of let the instrument drink the water in, because I feel, you know, it's going to feel so much happier. And then I leave hot water in the bath to try to keep the humidity level up. And I have a meter, a hygrometer, which measures all the time, you know, what the humidity level is. So I try to keep the cello happy. I mean, it's like a baby or a very old man. I'm not sure which.
Maybe a little bit of both.
But you know, it's a major consideration at this time of the year. And certainly, you know, it's something that I'm thinking about all the time. I'm watching that meter, even in my own home. I'm watching that meter to make sure that it's okay, that we're within those kind of tolerances.
Now, I know that for pianos, concert pianos, that a lot of them, for that very reason, will have humidifiers that will, when they're not being played, you know, backstage, they are covered and all of that, but there's a humidifier that's trying to keep that humidity steady. Is there such a thing for cellos?
Well, actually, there is something that you can put into either into the cello case or even as a kind of rubber device, which is like a long tube with holes in it that you slide into the cello. It doesn't actually go all the way in, but it kind of sits hanging inside the instrument, which gives off a certain amount of humidity. And that is very, very helpful when it's in the case. But of course, once you expose the cello to a much bigger area in the room, that little tiny amount of moisture that's been seeping out is kind of nullified, really. So then it's a question of what's in the room. And actually, it's just making me think that, you know, the other thing is when the instrument's really cold, when you get into to play it, when you take it out of the case and start to play it, because there's the wood of the neck and the fingerboard, and, you know, there's a certain amount of wood that is holding the cold. And when you put your warm hands, you put your fingers on the strings and on the wood of the instrument, all the heat goes straight out of your hands. So even if you feel warm and you've done some extra warm-ups because of the cold, when you start to play the instruments, your hands can suddenly get really, really cold because all the heat disappears into the instrument.
I was going to ask, because not only is the instrument affected, obviously, by the cold, but so is the musician. And yeah. I hadn't even thought of that, but that's a basic law of physics. How long does it take for that to equalize?
Well, I mean, if you're playing in a church, which is cold, the instrument may never really warm up. And your hands also may never really warm up, because even though you're generating heat in your body as you move, it just goes out of your hand so quickly into the wood. And you might just struggle to kind of keep relaxed and, you know, not to even injure yourself in cases like that.
I wonder if, and I have no idea how this would work, but are there such things as fingerless gloves that you can play with that are skin tight? You know, not the kind of bulky ones that we think of, you know, Scrivener type gloves, but, you know, I was thinking there must be some sort of thing that would not affect your playing ability and your ability to respond and feel the instrument, but would also try to keep some of that heat in your hands.
Well, you've got me going now. I'm going to have to research that.
I think we have to invent it.
Yeah.
If it hasn't happened.
The thing that I do sometimes do is that I have kind of a soft cloth, which I use for just dusting the instrument, or they were taking the rosin off the instrument after I've used it. And sometimes when I know the instrument's really cold, what I'll do is I'll just place that cloth on some sort of radiator or something warm, not too warm, and then I'll just wrap the neck of the cello in that cloth for a few seconds to try to, you know, to warm it up very slightly, at least take the chill out of it, which is a way of helping me more than anything else.
Right, because as you say, if your fingers are stiff, your hands are cold, your body's cold, we stiffen up. The wood gets stiff and brittle, so do we.
Yeah, and the weirdest thing is if you've been playing continuously for an hour and you are really warm, but your hands are still cold, it's just a very disturbing feeling. You know, it's just very unnatural. But that's just one of the things that we have to deal with that maybe nobody really thinks about. They may be shivering with their coats and hats on in the audience, maybe with rugs over their knees. But they think we're warm because we're so active. But in fact, we might be freezing cold too.
Right, and trying desperately to make music while you're freezing cold. Yeah.
Yes.
Have you ever had a time where you did take the cello out of the case and found, oh my gosh, a crack?
Well, actually, I did. Not a crack, luckily. I did once open my case and found that one of the joins, which are normally glued, completely open. So between the front of the instrument and the sides of the instrument, I could literally put my hand in. It was one of the most shocking experiences I can remember. And it's because the instrument's under so much pressure by the strings through the bridge onto the belly of the instrument. There's so much pressure that if some of the joints open, they can literally spring open, maybe, you know, a quarter of an inch, half an inch, or even more sometimes. And that's also happening a lot. And I've heard also from other musicians in the last few days who've had that problem. And it's not something that can be fixed really, really quickly because it has to be re-glued and repressed and the glue has to dry. And they can't use super glue or anything like that because the way instruments are made, that glue has to, in a way, it has to fail before the wood cracks. So it's better that the glue fails than the wood.
Right, because if it was super glue, then the wood would just crack around it.
That's right. Yeah. And also when you have to have some maintenance done on the instruments, so very occasionally, they do actually have to be opened up. And that glue has to melt easily using heat and so on in the right way. So the instrument maker can take it apart without, again, cracking or destroying the wood.
So what did you do when you found that it had split? Did you have to use a different instrument?
Yeah, I did, actually. I took my cello straight away to an instrument maker who set to work, and then I had to borrow something in the meantime. Luckily, I wasn't on tour or anything, so I was able to, you know, just to work on this other instrument to practice and not to actually have to give a concert. But it was a kind of wake-up call for being yet more attentive to humidity levels and temperature levels all the time. And it's that sticking towels in the vents, in the air conditioning vents in hotel rooms to stop it drawing out all the humidity from the room, you know.
Which is actually better for your sinuses, too, when you think about it.
We
don't do well in that super dry weather either. I mean, we're living things just like the wood was. So
that's absolutely true. And just the other day when I put the shower on in the hotel room and it was steaming out, I just immediately felt, oh, that's so nice to get that. Breathe in that humidity. It's actually really kind of relaxing.
You and the cello relaxing in the humidity. Well, with that image in my mind, I want to thank you very much. And here's hoping that your wintry stuff goes away soon and that spring arrives. And the next time we talk to each other, we will not be worrying about it being too cold.
Let's hope for that.
Robert, as always, it's such a pleasure.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Cellist Robert Cohen joins us each month in our series On That Note.
We'll take one last break and then hear about a way to combat the opioid epidemic that focuses on harm reduction rather than on punitive measures. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. ¶¶
We're back with more of Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Opioid abuse is at epidemic levels at just about every corner of this country. From heroin to narcotic painkiller abuse, opioid addiction hits many different demographic groups in urban, suburban, and in rural America. But the United States is not the only country that has been dealing with the issue.
But in this country, while there's guidance and direction from the federal government, it's often up to states and municipalities to develop strategies to stem the crisis. Hannah Hetzer believes it would be wise for state and federal agencies to study the examples in several other countries that have gotten the issue better under control. Hetzer is senior international policy manager for the New York-based Drug Policy Alliance, and she joined us in the studio recently. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I know one of the focuses of your time here in Milwaukee is to put the opioid crisis here in the United States in an international context. So can you give us a sense for where else in the world this is an especially acute issue?
Sure. So drug epidemics are not new, neither in this country or in the world. And I don't think we're seeing anywhere right now that's having the same level of overdose crisis in terms of death and harms related to drugs as in North America, particularly the U.S. and Canada. But if we look to other countries that have had really nefarious drug epidemics, we can also learn a lot from some of the policies that they implemented to curb some of those effects. And so two really great examples of countries that were dealing with really rough drug epidemics and then instituted public health approaches were Switzerland and Portugal. Both in the 80s and 90s, they had severe heroin epidemics, public use, sharing syringes, high rates of HIV, hepatitis C, and drug overdose deaths. And both of those countries decided, instead of promoting a punitive carceral approach, they implemented a range of policies under the umbrella of harm reduction. And I can go into those, but I think it would be good for us to look to those examples because we can both look at a bit of our history within the U.S. and learn from ourselves to not repeat the mistakes that we've made in the past, but also look to other countries to learn from them. And so from the U.S., I would say that the way that we're looking at the opioid crisis now sounds different than the way that we've talked about other epidemics like the crack epidemic in the 80s and 90s, where it was very focused on punitive approaches and there was no support given. And that largely has to do with the population that was associated with that epidemic in public perception, which was largely Black Americans. And now that the people who are associated with this current epidemic are assumed to be more white, we're hearing more in terms of public health language. And that's great, but it would behoove us to remember that history so that when we are thinking about public health approaches, we know that we should implement them, you know, fairly and equally, and not rush to criminalize like we did then, and which created, you know, a wave of mass incarceration.
Well, and so then talk about the significance of the idea of harm reduction as a policy.
Sure. So harm reduction as kind of a philosophy basically has to do with a set of programs whose aim is to reduce the risks and harms associated with drug use, but not necessarily having the end goal of abstinence. Abstinence can be an outcome, but it's not the only outcome. And a lot of our treatment options are based on abstinence methods. And that doesn't really take into account the reality that most people who do struggle with drug addiction will relapse, may not be able to be abstinent immediately in 1 month or potentially ever. And so with people who cannot stop using drugs, we want to make sure that they can stay alive, that their other health indicators are as good as they can be. So it's reducing the most kind of risky behaviors associated with drug use. And those strategies can fall kind of anywhere from, well, I'll briefly name five that have been proven around the world to be successful, and some of which we're doing in the U.S. and we should ramp up, and others which I think we should begin promoting. So the first is, of course, expanding access to naloxone, which is the overdose reversal medication, because you cannot treat someone if they're dead, and the main aim is saving lives here. So we need to put naloxone in the hands of police, of community members, of people who are closest to people who might overdose. The second is opioid substitution therapy, which is methadone, buprenorphine, and those are the treatment modalities that have been shown to cut overdose deaths in by 50%, and they're supported by the World Health Organization and really are the most effective treatment. So we should ramp up those. This is going to sound, you know, controversial, but heroin-assisted treatment for people who don't respond to methadone and buprenorphine. And that's a smaller percentage of people who struggle with opioid addiction. But the idea is you get them in a medical setting and give them pharmaceutical-grade heroin with sterile equipment under the supervision of doctors and nurses and health workers. And that was done in Switzerland when they were having, in, you know, the worst part of their epidemic.
And then do you taper them or?
You provide what they need at first. It's really the strategy is meeting people where they're at. So whatever they need, the amount that they need to not overdose, but where they don't get severe withdrawal, and then it can be lowered as amounts. And some people are able to go into abstinence and recover or go into methadone, and some people are on heroin-assisted treatment for, you know, years or potentially the rest of their life. But ever since Switzerland did that, they've never had one single overdose in that facility. And people who previously were injecting, you know, in the park now can have jobs and maintain kind of a stable lifestyle. So, you know, it sounds controversial, but it has been done and it has worked. So I think we should look to that. And then something that I'm quite glad to see is advancing in the U.S., especially in some cities like Philadelphia and San Francisco, and I think Seattle and Denver are considering opening what's called supervised consumption sites, which the only one in North America is in Vancouver in Canada. And that's basically a place where people can bring their drugs in. And again, they get their, you know, sterile equipment and are overseen by health workers. And there's never been a fatal overdose in any of those facilities. And I think the last intervention that you could tie into supervised consumption sites is drug checking. So a lot of people overdose because they might not know what's in their drugs. And that's becoming increasingly problematic with fentanyl and heroin that's laced with fentanyl. And it's that much more, you know, strong than heroin, and people aren't necessarily aware of what they're consuming, so they'll take it and overdose. And drug checking, it's been done in Europe and Latin America more in kind of the nightlife setting for people who are going to festivals and parties, but is becoming more appropriate and important to use for the opioids as well.
How do the economics of a public health approach compare to those of a punitive approach?
Sure. So major studies have been done around this, all say that it is more expensive to incarcerate someone than it is to treat someone. Incarceration is incredibly expensive. I think it's something around, I think it's around $40,000 or $60,000 per inmate. And it also does nothing to actually help with the treatment and recovery if someone is in there for drug use. So you're paying for someone being in prison, and you're also, that person is not in society, not able to work, and they then will leave prison and still have even less of a chance of getting a job and still might be dealing with, you know, a substance abuse disorder. Harm reduction methods are vastly cheaper. You're saving the cost on incarceration, and the cost of treatment, of medical assisted treatment, of syringes is just much lower than of incarceration. So I think, you know, when people are concerned around potentially shifting this from a criminal justice approach to a public health approach, it is good to remind it that that is not only more humane, it's actually the cheaper option.
There is something of a significant paradigm shift that would have to happen in this country for people to wrap their heads around the idea that we're not necessarily pushing abstinence on drug users.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the cultural shift is going to be the hardest. And there is still so much stigma around people who use drugs. I mean, the way that the media is, the terms that people use for people who use drugs is still just incredibly sad and really dehumanizing. And we are brought up with a very fixed idea of the harms of drugs and therefore the demonization of people who fall into addiction. And that is something that we all really need to change about the way we talk about people who use drugs. And that these are they are like, deserving.
Words like junkie.
Like junkie, exactly. Junkie is still a pretty commonly used word. Even, you know, terms like addicts, it, people are not willing to use people first words, language for people who use drugs. And that really needs to change. And I think it might be, you know, one of the tragedies about this epidemic is how widespread it is. And it's affecting a lot of people's family members. And so there might be an associated effect of people becoming a little bit more destigmatizing because it is their children and it is their loved ones. But I would hope we could do that even if it's not our family member, even if it's not our community, because people who use drugs, they're not morally backward. You're not morally bankrupt if you choose to use drugs. People use drugs for a number of different reasons. And if you fall into addiction patterns, it's not often your fault and you still deserve help and support.
How do the cultural shifts take place in say, Switzerland and Portugal?
I think in both of those cases, it was actually really, it was from the top down. It was leadership. So it was the government that decided in Portugal to decriminalize the use of all drugs, including heroin. And in Switzerland, it was the then president or health minister at the time. Both of those countries decided they had studied the issue, they had commissions, and they thought it was the right thing to do. And I think at first, it might not have been the most popular changes, especially in Portugal, you know, the conservative parties and kind of the conservative public were quite astounded by this policy. And now no one is talking about reverting back from decriminalization, not even the conservative parties. So I guess if you have the political leadership to do it and that you can prove that then these health approaches are actually beneficial, then the public will follow. Unfortunately, I think right now the public is going to have to lead and a lot of the answers are going to have to be on the community-based level, municipal government and state government. And hopefully it will, you know, peter up to the top.
Hannah Hetzer, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hannah Hetzer is Senior International Policy Manager for the New York-based Drug Policy Alliance. She was in Milwaukee to speak about the opioid crisis to UWM's Institute of World Affairs.
Time today for some music. Milwaukee guitar virtuoso Greg Koch and his band, the Koch Marshall Trio, stopped by the studio last week to celebrate the launch of their first album, Toby Arrives, and their first anniversary as a band.
We'll hear the entire interview in the coming weeks, but here is the band performing a tune that Greg calls Funk Meat. We'll be right back.
The Koch Marshall Trio performing in Lake Effect Studio C1. We will hear the entire interview with the band, plus some more music from their debut album in the coming weeks. But right now, that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening, because fresh air is next.